Hello and welcome to the SEAI's 180 Degrees podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan, and over the course of the next 12 episodes, I'll be joined by special guests to talk about the state of play of Ireland's energy revolution, how we can be smarter energy users, what renewable technologies are coming into our homes and communities, and how small businesses can benefit from decarbonising now. For something so silent, electric vehicles are making a lot of noise on the car market. EVs are heralded as the successor to fossil fuel-based internal combustion engines, with one in five new passenger vehicles sold in Ireland last year being electric. In this episode, I am joined by Fergus Sharkey, Head of Business Supports and Transport at SEAI, and Simon Acton, e-mobility expert and the founder and managing director of Next Eco Car, which is a used electric car sourcing business. We dig deep and get down into the real truths about EVs, how affordable they are, what options do you have when it comes to paying for them or leasing them, and we take a look at the second-hand market, at the charging infrastructure, destination charging and grant supports, of course, which are available. Welcome, Fergus and Simon.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, thanks.
Now, let's start, I think, with the macro in terms of an overview of the market. It is a huge plank of government policy now that we need to shift to EVs. So much so that there have been bans put in place in 2030, 2045 to get diesel and petrol engines off our roads. Where do we stand now in terms of the market? What was the goal for 2024 or by this time? And where are we at?
Yeah, it's an important question. And you contextualise it very well there, Sinead. It's a part of our strategy to reduce emissions in the transport sector. It's not the only piece. You know, we can't just get a million EVs on the road and are done. There's a lot of other parts to it. So at the moment, there's north of 2 million vehicles on Irish roads. Of them, around 110,000 are electric vehicles today.
Gosh, it's not a lot, is it?
No. So that's around 4 or 5%. And it's important to say, when we say electric vehicles in that context, we're talking about both battery electric vehicles, so 100% electric vehicles, and we're talking about plug-in hybrid electric vehicles.
Now, that's an important distinction.
Yes.
Because there are only when we get on to talk about grants, there's only grants available for the fully electric, isn't
Correct.
That right?
Yes, so there was grants available up until 2021 for plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, but there are only grants available for full battery electric vehicles.
Yeah, so you have
now
to be careful if you're kind of tipping your toe into this market and you're considering what type of EV to buy. There are different types and some are kind of, more affordable than others.
There's effectively pros and cons for the different types, which we'll get into.
We'll come on and talk about that. Yeah. So in terms then of the market, so it doesn't sound like we're going to hit what we were supposed to hit by 2030, or are you confident that we will?
I think it's going to be a big challenge to hit the 2030 target. We're going to hit our 2025 target and exceed it. So our 2025 target is 175,000 electric vehicles on the road. Mm. And we'll likely exceed that. We might be close to it actually by the end of 2024. So we might exceed that. The target for 2030 is 950,000 electric vehicles, give or take. About 850,000 of those are private electric vehicles, so cars, and the rest are commercial vehicles, heavy goods vehicles and so on. So,
and there's also a big move on the commercial side for buses, for instance, and other vehicles, kind of commercial vehicles, to move to the EV market. And I suppose that's where people maybe will see it as a game changer, because they travel further distances, they're heavier, and yet they're coping quite well with that. Is there an extra push to get companies and state organisations to move to electric?
Yeah, there absolutely is. There's grants there. A lot of people will think about the private vehicle grants when they're listening in, but there's grants for commercial vehicles, both small regular vans and large panel vans. And there's grants for heavy goods vehicles, for the differential between them and traditional vehicles. Now, there's a lot of vans on the market. There's a lot of vans available from your typical van dealerships. There's not as many heavy goods vehicles. You know, there's not as many buses available. But you'll see that Athlone has moved to 100% bus fleet. You'll see that Dublin Bus are bringing a lot of electric buses onto the fleet and so on. So they're starting to make inroads. Where you won't see them immediately would be the likes of intercity buses, which might be looking at alternative fuels like hydrogen, because they would have those longer journeys. But where there's a repeatable, identifiable journey, such as on post and DPD would be examples, they know exactly where the vans are going to be going in a given day.
So you can calculate and plan for your battery.
Exactly.
And of course, the thing about it is, as we move on in terms of time, the technology is going to get better and the efficiency of new batteries. Okay, so that's where we're at. A lot done, more to do, as somebody might say. So we're on target for 2025, and it just seems like a yawning gap to 2030. But as you say, we may well get there. Talk to me a little bit, Simon, and I might come to you about the charging infrastructure, because it is one of the bugbears that people constantly talk about. They want to do the longer journeys. They want to be able to drive from Dublin to Cork or Cork to Galway. And they find that they cannot get the charging points. They pull in, they're either all occupied, they have to hang around for an hour. We surely should be doing more in there, or is that a little bit of a myth?
Well, I think the first thing to talk about when we think about charging is that, you know, most people will charge at home. So normally you'd be starting any journey with, you know, a full charge on any given day. So for people that can charge at home, which at the moment is something like 80% of people that own EVs, and obviously that will become less as people start getting them who live in apartments and so on, but a lot of people will, over time, always be charging at home. So with the sort of vehicles that we have being sold now, we're talking about cars with a range of 400, 500 kilometres, you know, with a full charge. So if you're starting your journey with that sort of charge, then you're going quite a long way before you actually need to charge en route. So I think that's the first thing to say. There is huge investment in high power charging infrastructure. We are certainly not seeing it being rolled out as quickly as we would like, but there's an awful lot in train that's going on. And we've seen, particularly with ESBE cars and EasyGo, who are an Irish company, a lot of infrastructure added this year. Yes, we do need more. Oftentimes, if you're traveling off peak, you might get to one of the hubs and find that there's nothing being used. But whereas if you go at a weekend, you might find that you might have to wait. And I think that's where a lot of the issues lie and where we need to scale up.
What is the etiquette around those charging points? Because, you know, we're kind of speaking a new language now, and you know, when it comes to EV chargers, because it's, to me, it's a little bit like parking at the petrol pump when all you're doing is going into the shop. You're not buying petrol at all, but you're taking up a space. What is the etiquette when it comes to parking in a charging point that clearly is marked as such?
Well, I guess there are two different types of charger, broadly speaking. There are rapid chargers, which, you know, they're the ones you're going to be there for half an hour, 45 minutes. And certainly you certainly shouldn't park in any charging bay if you're not actually going to be charging your car. It's a charging bay, not a parking space. So I think if you're using a rapid charger, then, you know, the etiquette used to be, yeah, you should probably stay with your car. But realistically, you know, a lot of the places where you would charge now, like forecourts, would have, you know, an opportunity to go and get a coffee or get some food or take a break or whatever. So as long as you're, you know, back to your car within the kind of 45 minutes is the kind of accepted norm.
Okay.
Which for most cars would be plenty of time to get enough range in to get to continue your journey. Then that's, you know, that's the way you should operate. A lot of cars will, or a lot of charging networks will have apps, so you can actually see if your car has stopped sooner than maybe you expected, so you should go back, and there are tools to allow you to do that. If you're on a public slow charger, which might be more typically kind of on a road or a shopping centre or something like that, and then it's a slower charger, then it's fine to stay for a longer period of time, and people should expect that. But again, it's not a parking space, it's a charging bay.
Charging bay, okay, yeah. That's the terminology we need, right? It's not for you to park your regular car there. Okay, can I talk a little bit about some of the myths, or maybe not, that have built up around the whole idea of EV transport and where we're all going with it. I mean, the first one, and the one that's hung around the longest, is the range anxiety. Now, Simon, you just said, okay, cars could have, say, 400 kilometres or something, but is not the case that sometimes if you have your heating on, you have the radio on, you have your lights on, you've other electrics, that actually that can wear down your battery a little bit. I mean, I see a lot of ads from Carmark saying we have a huge range. I mean, enough to get from Kerry to Donegal, say. But in reality, is that fair?
You need to be a little bit careful. So when you buy any car, whether it's, you know, from a new car from a dealer, they quote what's called the WLTP range. It's like a standard test cycle that all cars go through to assess their efficiency and how far they should be able to go, whether that be, you know, whether that be on a tank of fuel or a full charge from a battery. And so that's a standard, that's an industry standard. So, and that will give you things for traditional cars like the quoted miles per gallon that you should get. So,
but we know in a petrol car, for instance, that can change if you're doing stop-start driving or if you're on a motorway. So it's the same kind of thing. You have to be mindful. Like, don't take it with a pinch of salt, but be mindful it can change.
So one of the things I do when I'm selling electric cars to people is I will give them a more realistic range based on my experience of a particular model. So, and you're right to a certain extent that obviously, if you're driving in the summer, you probably, you know, you might not have your heating on and so on. But in the winter, you'll have your aircon on. And also, batteries are less efficient in colder conditions. So, but there are a few things that kind of play in to help this. A lot of cars now will preheat their batteries. So that will mean that they're, you know, they're not starting from cold and they will be more efficient in colder conditions. So that helps as well. So the real thing that can impact range is, you know, in the winter versus the summer is whether you are running your aircon. Now, what I always say to people is ballpark, expect maybe 20% less range during the winter compared to the summer.
Oh, okay.
So it's not, you know, as bad as people might think. Yeah.
And of course, it's tempered by the fact, you know, when we think of the range anxiety and we think of hundreds of kilometres, most journeys are not hundreds of kilometres, are they?
No, not at all. I mean, I think the average journey is something like 30 kilometres per day, if you kind of even it all out. I mean, obviously, a lot of people will only, you know, use their cars to, you know, take the kids to school, commute to work and what have you. Most people aren't doing hundreds of kilometres every day. So I think one of the things to consider as well when you're buying a vehicle is what are your typical journeys and what do you really need? Do you need to buy the really expensive EV with the really big battery, or will a cheaper one with a smaller battery actually suffice for what you need to do? And certainly what I've seen is a lot of people who maybe be where they have two cars would be swapping out their second car for an EV. So they kind of have,
so they have the option. Yeah.
So if a particular journey is really beyond the means of the EV, then they can use the other car. But the feedback I've had from customers is I've actually used the EV a lot more than I thought I would, because once you get used to the range,
the anxiety goes.
Exactly.
And the driving experience is a lot nicer.
It's a lot more relaxing.
Okay. And of course, it has got better over the years. So maybe people have that fixed in their head for the wrong reason. So, Fergus, then let's talk about another issue that people have. And it's about battery life. So, you know, you are buying a new EV, but you want to make sure it's going to last until your natural cycle of change, because they're kind of expensive to replace if you're doing that, aren't they?
Yeah. So another one of the classic myths about EVs is that you'll need to replace the battery after you've done, I don't know, 100,000 kilometers or something like that, which is completely false. I suppose there's a couple of things on batteries is they do degrade over time. In the same way that an internal combustion engine becomes less efficient over time, it's not going to get you the miles per gallon after 200,000 kilometres that it did when you rolled it out of the dealership. And one of the key things is battery care. And battery care, I suppose, there's two elements to that. One is the amount of DC fast charging you do. So a battery that just predominantly only does DC charging will degrade quicker than a battery that does home charging, if you wish, which is AC charging or low power charging over time. So where you see that sort of being reported, maybe taxi drivers who are doing a lot of DC driving, you can see that being reported in there. And then outside of that, it's how you manage your battery during its lifetime. The manufacturers would say try and keep it between 20 and 80% for most of its life, and then obviously 100% if you need it for a long journey. So you try and keep it almost like they say about your phone.
Topped up.
Yeah. I charge my own car maybe kind of two nights a week, and then it typically is running around 60, 70%.
Okay,
and
so
then
that's
for a long journey,
a
would bring it up to 100%.
Now, in the same way that, you know, we were told to keep the phone charged up, and one of the things about a mobile phone is another battery issue is don't keep it under your pillow. You know, it could go on fire, and then people are thinking about their EV. Well, that's a much bigger battery. What concerns do people have about that?
Yeah, so again, another myth comes up all the time is that EVs are either more likely to go on fire or do go on fire, which is a bit of an odd one. They don't. Again, they're statistically about 20 or 30 times less likely to go on fire than internal combustion engines. I'm sure they do go on fire, as do regular internal combustion engine vehicles, which actually are full of, I suppose, flammable liquid. So, but you see all the time on social media, as soon as there's a fire in a car park or on a ferry, like a car ferry or something like that, you get this accusation that it must have been an EV, and inevitably it's a internal combustion engine vehicle. So no, they're not more likely to go on fire.
Okay, so that's another myth busted. One of the other ones that I've heard, because a lot of the reasons people buy EVs, of course, are for environmental reasons. They're trying to be eco-friendly. But cobalt is mined during the construction of these cars, and that's a rare earth mineral. So are they really as kind of eco-friendly as we're led to believe?
Yeah, so this again is, and this is a very legitimate one. So when we're bringing raw materials for anything we produce, EVs seem to be held to a higher standard for some reason, but anything we produce requires raw material, and that always has ethical considerations. And cobalt has been a major component of EV batteries. It's also a major component of any battery for a laptop or a phone. It's also used in the production of petrol, actually. It's a catalyst in the production of petrol, in the chemical processing of petrol. So it's used across a lot of different supply chains. What you've seen now is a lot of EV manufacturers move away from it for those reasons. So there's a lot of scrutiny on the ethical, I mean, the human impact, effectively, particularly in Africa. For people who are involved in these mining operations. So what we're seeing is several of the large Chinese manufacturers have completely moved away from cobalt-free batteries. So first of all, we don't need it. It's evidently we don't need cobalt for batteries. But, you know, the fundamental thing is the stuff going into what we're producing has to be produced ethically. And that is an important consideration. I don't think EVs have some, you know, unethical trademark that other sectors don't, but we have to be mindful of it.
Okay. Now, one of the areas which is not a myth is down to the price. And Simon, it does put people off changing their car because they have the view that electric vehicles are very expensive. Are they more expensive than the equivalent petrol or diesel car in reality?
Well, I think one of the important things to consider is like your total ownership cost. And what people don't do is, you know, they just look at the sticker price on the car. So if you look at what might look like an equivalent combustion car versus an electric car, then sure, the sticker price will be more, slightly more, even considering the generous grants that are available. However, if you actually look at what it's going to cost you to run that vehicle in terms of your charging costs in particular, but also things like your maintenance costs, you will find that over a period of 3 to 5 years, you'll be winning with an EV.
Ah, okay. So, because things like servicing, you know, getting your NCT done, you know, things like that maybe are easier and quicker with an electric vehicle.
Sure. I mean, certainly if you put an EV in for an NCT, it will come out the other end a lot quicker, in my experience, because they don't have as many things to check. For example, they're not checking the emissions, so they're not doing a tailpipe NOx test or anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, but your general servicing is typically much less because you've no oil to change, which obviously you would every time in a combustion car. Brakes wear less on electric vehicles because the electric motor in an electric vehicle helps you brake by using what's called regenerative braking. So you're actually wearing your brake discs and your brake pads less. I regularly hear of people who have EVs who have done maybe more than 100,000 kilometres on a set of discs and pads. That's unheard of in a combustion vehicle.
Car. Now, of course, we have the whole area of fuel because we know how expensive diesel and petrol is at the moment, and we have ongoing global issues which are leading to those prices staying high. But of course, electricity is also impacted by those, and it is very expensive. So has the cost of running an EV gone up?
Well, yeah, sure. We have had a period of time where electricity prices have gone up, but over time, they will certainly come back down, and we've already started to see that. Whereas I think we're in a period now where we're starting to see combustion fuel prices actually go up again. So, yeah, it's not as cheap to run an EV right now as maybe it was 2 years ago. But there's a few things to kind of mitigate against that. What we're starting to see is EV-specific tariffs where, you know, it's cheaper to charge overnight, where there's abundant already abundant like renewable energy available on our grid, particularly, you know, after a windy night and things like that. So, but also, you know, if you've got solar panels on the roof of your house, you can actually be charging your car for free. So if you've got a setup where you've got, you know, solar panels and maybe a storage battery in your house, which I think will be a lot more common as time goes on, you can actually charge your car for free. You will never be able to do that with a combustion vehicle or a hydrogen vehicle by extension, which sure. is one so of the other things that's talked about.
I suppose then going back to our previous episodes and the episodes to come on the 180 Degrees podcast, this is a whole holistic conversation, isn't
yeah,
it?
It's very
not
much.
Just about cars or just solar panels or just about renewables. It's actually trying to integrate our lives, our property and our transport around the same topic. And isn't that really maybe where people should be maybe taking an umbrella, more an yeah. umbrella view of things?
I think one of the phrases I like to talk about is like your home energy ecosystem, because I mean, yeah, if you take electric vehicles in isolation, then you can maybe make an argument that, you know, maybe it's not as good as it could be. But if you then start to think about the other things I mentioned,
yeah.
then which will benefit you in other ways in your home as well, in terms of using that, getting cheaper electricity, then, you know, you can actually make quite a lot of inroads. And I think we'll start to see a lot more of that as time goes on.
Fergus, there has been a lot of commentary, particularly from outside the pale, as they say, about that rural-urban divide when it comes to electric vehicles. Now, some of it is merited, some of it may not be, but it is absolutely true to say that you are just simply not going to get as many charging points or do the short hops that maybe city dwellers would enjoy if you're living in the, you know, in a very remote rural area. What is the prospect for people like that and electric vehicles?
I think the prospect's very good. There's a couple of things at play, I guess. One is, I suppose, statistically, rural dwellers are going to drive longer distances, be it to work, be it to dropping their kids off at school, be it to do their socializing and shopping and so on. So they are going to deal with longer distances in the main. But again, they are longer, yes, than urban dwellers, but they are very, very small overall and well within the range capacity of modern EVs. We have to move past range. It used to be the case that maybe EVs were suitable to 60, 70% of the population. We're now touching on 90, 95% of the population. The only people EVs are not suitable for, from a practical sense, is somebody who's doing 400 or 500 kilometers a day, and they are very rare salespeople,
like traveling salesmen.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's just people who are up and down the borings and back roads and motorways of Ireland every day. So if you're in rural Ireland, you're almost guaranteed that you have off street parking, and then you can charge at the cheapest rate possible. And you were talking about it there. Like my experience is going from putting 200 euro of diesel into a car a year to putting 18 euros of electricity, sorry, a month. So I've gone from 200 euro to 18 euro of electricity to run my family car, and we only have one car. So in rural Ireland, obviously active and public transport options aren't as prevalent. And I think people will be screaming at their radio or iPhone or whatever they're listening to this on, saying that I don't have the opportunity for alternative modes in transport. So EVs are really important for rural Ireland. So we need to close some of the gaps in charging infrastructure. So what that means is that when you go down to your supermarket, when you go down to the cinema, that you have an opportunity to charge there. Or it means that if you are going from West Connemara and you're making your way and you're going to get up onto the N4 or the N6 at some point, that you're actually able to charge en route along that route, and you're not waiting till you get onto the main interurban network to charge.
Is there a market then, or maybe a government intervention that could be made in terms of community charging points specifically for rural areas, and not leaving it up to supermarket planners or private landlords who own space and say, "Ah, she will stick in a couple of EV points here." Like, should we be doing this as a state?
Yeah, and we are. So our colleagues in Zero Emission Vehicle Ireland, ZEVI, they have a number of schemes. So one is for sports clubs. So they're trying to identify sports clubs, GAA, soccer, whatever it might be, who have the electrical infrastructure that they can put in a relatively fast charger. And obviously, as we know, these sports clubs are in our communities. So that's an ideal opportunity if somebody has the electrical infrastructure. But then you also need to get them into other destinations. So, as you say, supermarkets, into where we meet.
Town squares, where
we leave our cars, yeah. I guess, for a couple of hours. Just think about that. You know, and every new commercial building has to have 10% of its spots with EV chargers. So any, and they would be typically mixed use buildings, you know, which would have shops and maybe apartments in them. So you'll get them in the urban environment, in small towns. You obviously don't get them out in the rural environment.
Okay, so that's good to know. So we've plenty on that. So let's move on then to the bit that people want to know about, which is the money and the grants that are available. Now, there were grants available, then they were not available. Now they're available again. Can you bring us up to speed with what people get if they get an electric car? What grants can they get for the car and for the charging point as it stands today?
Yeah, so for new electric vehicles, the grant is €3,500. So that was reduced this year in 2023 from 5,000. But most new vehicles that came on the market this year would have gotten 5,000. And what we've seen in response to that is most dealers are changing their prices. So you're actually not getting, you're not paying more. In actual fact, the vehicle I bought at the start of the year now is about 4,000 less, including a lower grant.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. But actually, isn't it the case that if we're supposed to be pushing this and the government wants more people to have EV cars, they should be increasing the grant, not reducing it?
It's arguable. I mean, we buy a lot of cars in Ireland. So you have to look at that sort of deadweight effect, that kind of, you know, people buy vehicles in Ireland. There's 120,000 sold roughly of new vehicles every year. So we're not trying to intervene in a market where nothing's happening. What we're trying to do is shift the dial over onto electric vehicles. And not only that, there's supply and demand dynamics at play. In 2022, I actually don't think dealers could have sold more vehicles than they got their hands on. There was a supply problem. So putting more money into the market there. But look, it's an arguable point. On top of the vehicle grant, there's a VRT relief of up to 5,000 as well. That for vehicles that are 40,000 or less, that's a full amount, and then it sort of tapers off for larger vehicles. And it's important to state as well that the SEAI grant isn't, if your vehicle's over 60,000, there's no grant. So you're more expensive.
You can afford it all by yourself. Is that the view?
And actually, we pay for about 2/3 of electric vehicles, battery electric vehicles. So we may, so 1/3 of the market is totally unfunded. So people do buy them anyway.
BIK. So for companies that are trying to encourage their employees to take up company cars that are electric, they are exempt, are they, from benefit in kind?
There's a relief of 35,000 from benefit in kind. And actually, that was meant to drop to 20,000 in 2024 and 10,000 in 2025, but it's been put off till the end of 2025 now.
Okay.
So it won't drop till the end of 2025.
So you might get fleets changing over.
Would be very, very typical for company cars.
Okay.
And on top of all of that, you get, whether it's a newer or used vehicle, you get €600 towards your home charger, which is another expense, putting in a home charger. So whether that's new or secondhand, or in fact, even if you don't have an electric vehicle, you can get that grant. So maybe that you want to have it there for your granny who drives an electric vehicle or something.
All right, so add it up. That's quite a bit. Yeah. Simon, talk to me about the types of cars that people can buy. It seems to me that on one hand, you have this dichotomy of people who want to migrate to an electric vehicle. Maybe there's a little bit of a social cachet about an electric vehicle. And yet here we are still obsessed with the MPVs and the SUVs. Are you finding when people are looking in the secondhand car market that they are buying bigger cars because there seems to be loads of them around?
I would say, I mean, one of the things to consider about the used market is, you know, that the vehicles are available is quite limited, maybe until quite recently. So there's a lot more variety now. One of the spaces that we do definitely lack in is, you know, 7-seaters. And a lot of, if I had €1 for every time I've been asked, is there an affordable electric 7-seater? You know, I'd be a rich man. But that, we don't really have that. So there is, you know, are people looking to buy bigger cars? People do like SUVs. I mean, the brands have been very active in marketing those sort of vehicles over the last number of years. And of course, those sort of vehicles, whilst they might be considered more practical, aren't necessarily so. People do like the higher seating position, but oftentimes the boot's not as big as it is on a traditional hatchback. And certainly they're not as efficient either. So what do I see? I mean, what I see is people typically coming to us who are looking for, you know, the money savings, and then probably as a secondary factor to, they've environmental and clean air considerations. So, yeah, what is true to say that over the last couple of years, there's a lot more variety in the market. We do need more variety to cover, you know, all different types of vehicles and demographics. But certainly, there's a huge amount of electric vehicles available on the second market. I took a quick look yesterday on Dundeal, for example, and there's something like 3,000 electric vehicles available to buy now. And, you know, that ranges from Nissan Leaf from 2011 right the way through to a Porsche Taycan, you know, so between 3,000 and 150,000 euros.
Right. And just to reiterate then, if somebody is nervous about buying a secondhand electric because they're worried about that battery life that we were talking about earlier, would you say maybe there's a year you shouldn't go behind or in a, you know, a mileage limit?
Well, mileage is only one factor. So that's kind of one thing to consider. I mean, we have one of the things my business does is we distribute a battery testing tool in this market. And I've used that for several years already to check the cars we're buying. There are very few electric cars that I've tested that I would consider the battery to have been a problem. And of those, that maybe they would be the much older ones, sort of pre-2013, like the first generation Nissan Leafs are probably getting a little bit long in the tooth at this stage. But having said that, any past sort of mid-2013 are still standing up very well. And they're 10-year-old cars now. And I still see 2013 cars with 80% of their battery health.
Wow. Okay.
So the idea that you would have to replace the battery within the lifetime of the car, even, you know, for cars that we're selling today, where the batteries are much better than new cars that have come out in the last 5 years, the batteries are different chemistry, much more sustainable. And also, typically come with like an seven, eight year warranty on the new cars that we're selling now. So the expectation is that those, the batteries in those vehicles will outlast the life of the car itself.
That's good to know now. And it just allows people maybe who are thinking of dipping their toe in this water and maybe just don't want to spend quite so much money just yet, that might be a good option for them into the market and knowing that they can be stood over, I suppose.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I do on any electric car, the first thing I do is test the battery to see that it's a good battery. Mm. As I said, most batteries stand up very well, but you obviously don't want to get the one that maybe isn't a good one, in the same way that, you know, if you're buying a combustion car, you want to make sure you've bought one where the oil has been changed.
It's, sure. You know, you'll be checking the same things, in other words.
Yeah. Like, so that technology exists to run those tests. And, you know, any dealer that's selling EVs, used EVs, should be using that to give their customers reassurance and, you know, and build that into a warranty process, which is what we're doing.
Good. Well, look, on that note, we leave it there. We've had a very wide-ranging discussion, and I thank you both, Fergus Sharkey and Simon Acton, for participating in it. Very helpful and very informative. And hopefully it has given you, the listener, a little bit more information around EVs and the marketplace for it and how things are progressing in that space. So thank you very much for tuning in. And next week we'll have a mini episode where Fergus and I will take 5 minutes to answer your questions on EVs. If you've enjoyed this episode of the 180 Degrees podcast, well then why not review and subscribe to it now? And of course, share it with family and friends to find out more about renewables and energy. Well then, check out seai.ie.